Hey guys, and welcome to episode 76 of the OCDstories.com podcast. Now in this episode, I had a great chat with Kimberly Quinlan. Kimberly is a therapist over in the States, and we talked about various things, but the podcast and the chat was mainly comprised of questions that you guys gave me. So I put out on, I think, Instagram, Facebook and Twitter, basically saying, do you have any questions? I've got a OCD and anxiety specialist coming on, and you gave me quite a few questions, and I asked seven of them. Things including like how to deal with repetitive thoughts, how to overcome fear, what to do if you're having a panic attack, and Kimberly gave some great answers. We also talked about mindfulness for OCD and some general advice about things she thinks people should start and stop doing with OCD. And she put a real emphasis on compassion, which is something I fully believe in. You know, we had Professor Paul Gilbert on before around compassion. She really emphasized that. Just the real kind of the mindfulness aspect. She talked about kind of Buddhism as well a little bit. And I think you're going to really like Kimberly and what she had to say. She gave some real practical advice, and you can tell she loves what she does and brings a lot of humanity into her practice, which I appreciate. Thank you to Charlotte Nicely, who's been on the podcast a few times. She actually put me in contact with Kimberly, so thank you for the recommendation, Charlotte. And without further ado, here is Kimberly. On today's show, I have Kimberly Quinlan. Kimberly is a licensed marriage and family therapist who treats people with OCD and related disorders, eating disorders, and body-focused repetitive disorders. She runs her own podcast called Your Anxiety Toolkit. Kimberly also trained at the OCD Center of Los Angeles and later became the clinical director. Now, welcome to the show, Kimberly.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Brilliant. I didn't check. Did I get your surname right?
You got it.
Okay, great. Yeah. So I always start with getting people's OCD story if they have one, or in this case therapy story. You know, what got you into being a therapist, what motivated you?
Let me tell. When I was dealing with my own anxiety and disordered eating struggles that I was going through, my husband for Christmas gave me a book on Buddhism. It was an intro book to Buddhism, and it was a sharp turn towards recovery at that moment. It was amazing how just a couple of concepts shifted some things for me. So I decided to become a therapist. And I wanted to specialize mostly in the anxiety part because that seemed to be what I had struggled with. Yeah. So I sought out to work for whoever would take me to treat anxiety. And I really quickly landed a job at the OCD Center and immediately immersed myself into the OCD community. And I just adored it immediately. Yeah. So it all kind of went from there. I mean, I continued to sort of dabble around in the Buddhist philosophy, and then really made my way into, you know, really working with CBT and then a heavy emphasis on mindfulness. And from there, it's just continued to be, you know, the journey.
Okay, now that's awesome. Yeah, as I say, sometimes there's like, it sounds like loads of things came together at the right time and the right situation, but also it almost feels like sometimes there's someone meddling in a good way.
Right.
Okay, cool. So I noticed on your site you put anxiety disorders such as OCD are highly treatable, and highly in all caps, emphasizing the highly point. And it's something I fully agree with, but I know I get people sometimes push back against that idea that, you know, they've done CBT a few times and they've struggled. So I guess just what's your take on why it's highly treatable?
Well, I think unfortunately, you know, so often I get a call from a parent or a partner or someone who is struggling with OCD who's incredibly frustrated because they've said, I've had CBT. You know, I've done the CBT part and that's not working. And this is where I'm sure a lot of the people who've spoken with on your podcast have said it as well, is it's really important that you just don't take the CBT part and you make sure you use the ERP. And as soon as you're using the exposure and response prevention and you're doing it correctly, which is the other important part, it is highly treatable. It's not to say it's easily, I mean, I definitely didn't include easily in the description, but it is highly treatable. But it's important to identify that treatable doesn't mean you walk away, you know, skipping down the path. That's not the direction I'm trying to lead us down. It's more of that it's doable. And I think the reason I emphasize that on my website is so many people, by the time they come to my website, are hopeless and feel like their case is the case that's never going to be fixed.
Yeah, no, thanks for explaining. Okay, cool. So I've got quite a few user questions now. I don't know why I wrote user actually now in hindsight. Listener questions from Twitter and Facebook. And the first one is, how do you know if what you're thinking, feeling, and experiencing is truly you or OCD?
Right, that's a great question. It's probably one of the lines that we have to master in session the most as well. I don't actually think any of our thoughts are actually me, whether or not they're OCD or not. I'll share with my clients that, you know, while I have a lot of experience in OCD and I feel like some of my past stuff has sort of been somewhat associated with a similar process, you and I or anyone might have a thought that could be OCD, but that a thought doesn't make us who we are. A thought is something that, you know, is something we experience, and that's limited to that. And so, you know, I often explain with clients, like, your life and your brain is kind of like the news, you know, when you're watching the news and here's the telereporter and it's talking, and then at the very bottom is the little line at the bottom that's sort of telling you the updates of all of the other stuff that's going on. They're your thoughts. Your thoughts are just scrolling along. It doesn't have to really identify with us. It doesn't have to really have any value at all.
Yeah, no, that's a really good point. And also, I guess, that question is kind of the million-dollar question. Like, if you know it's OCD, then you wouldn't have OCD, or it right. wouldn't bother you as much. Okay, right. So another listener question is, bear with me, it's a long one. Tips on how to ride out the anxiety when you're trying to cut out a compulsion. For example, I know one of the toughest compulsions for me is to cut out not reassurance seeking, but sometimes the anxiety gets too much and then I go and seek it. How can I endure the anxiety more and more and not give in to the compulsion?
And did you say how can I enjoy it?
Endure.
Or endure it. Yeah. Okay. I often talk with clients about this idea of occupation. Often, if someone's doing an exposure, of course their anxiety is going to be high, right? And often people get themselves caught up in this idea of how can I get it to go back down? And conceptually, that's a problem in and of itself, right? Because really, I always say to clients, like, a really good exposure is the ones that are really anxiety provoking and that you do sit with them. But the idea of occupation is going about your life while having that anxiety, right? I never would encourage a client to do an exposure and then sit back in their chair and just take it, right? That can be brutal. And the truth is, that's not what life looks like. You can't do that if you're sitting for a test. You can't do that if you're walking down the aisle going to get married. That doesn't work for many reasons. So the idea of occupation is, can you just be an observer of your anxiety, of the physical sensations that you have? Can you be an observer of the thoughts that you have? While you go about your life, whether that be putting the clothes into the washing machine, it might be doing the things you love, and that's a really important step, is, you know, while you're doing an exposure, go in out into nature. If you're going to feel the anxiety, you might as well go for a walk. I know you recently podcasted about that, which I'm a big advocate for. And then again, this, like I said before, is the second part, the next part there is just really willingly allowing anxiety to be there with compassion, right? If you're not going to be compassionate during that time, I actually work with clients on actually being compassionate for the whole experience of anxiety. Like, you know, your brain literally is sending off the alarm system. Let's actually be compassionate for the fact that it's done that in many times that has been helpful in terms of, you know, an earthquake or, you know, anxiety has a purpose too.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Like the first point, yeah, I 100% agree. It's kind of like, if you're going to have these thoughts, go have them somewhere beautiful. Why stay in your bedroom? But also that second point about, yeah, I like the linking it to the earthquake about how, you know, that would naturally cause a huge amount of anxiety, and rightly so. But also there would be a huge amount of compassion, if not for yourself, at least for others. And yeah, I guess it's about nurturing that within, as you say, in the therapy session.
Right. One thing I find myself do with my clients, and I'll tilt down here, is when they're talking about painful things, I automatically put my hand over my chest, over my heart. I don't even know I'm doing it most of the time anymore, but for some reason that connects me to compassion.
Yeah.
Right. And so, and I often, when I do it, I notice my client does it too. Like they automatically mirror it. And there is a global compassion that comes from even something so simple. So anytime you can connect with something that brings you back to that compassion piece, I think can be very, very helpful when you're going through something very, very difficult.
Yeah, no, I really like that. And it reminded me of something. I'm in therapy at the minute, but it's like general sort of talking, psychotherapy, nothing to do with OCD. Well, not in the direct sense. And she will occasionally, if I talk about something quite emotive, let's say from my childhood, I noticed she'll put her hand there. And at first I was like, and she does the face you just did. And at first I'd be like, why is she doing that? Like, this is, and I understand why now. Hopefully it's not a trick for her. It's something she, like you said, you generally feel it and you're.
Right. There's a softening that happens for me. I always say to people, do what works for you. Like some other people might find a different motion, or it doesn't have to be any motion, but there's a softening that happens. Whereas otherwise, I think when we're really anxious and we're doing an exposure, our whole body gets very tight. Right. And I think body language has a lot to do that. In fact, I learned but when I was in labor with my daughter, my first child, one of the nurses came over and she tapped me on the shoulder and she said, soften your hands. And I'm thinking to her, like, why? I'm in the most pain I've ever been in my life. Why would you tell me that? But it's interesting how when I open my palms up, I was unable to hold all of that tension in my body. And I talk with clients about that too, even though they're not in labor, in that softening your hands or softening something can create a wave effect.
Yeah, no, I really like that. I got married recently and we're on our honeymoon flying to Italy, and my wife gets anxious flying. So do I, to be fair. But so she holds my hand. I notice when there's turbulence, she almost breaks my hand because she's holding it so tight. And I just have to tell her, like, you know, loosen your grip, because I know that the more you tense up, the more you're setting off that anxious sort of fire alarm.
It's a powerful thing that we do to brace ourselves. Sometimes we have to correct it.
There's a lot our body does that I feel if we change our body, as you're saying, we can change our state of mind, which I don't think it's talked about enough, especially maybe from a depression standpoint of, you know, you're very slumped over, you're hunched, and maybe even just kind of forcing your shoulders back, head up, and just hold that position for a minute and see what it does to your mental state.
Right.
I mean, it's not cure depression, but it might just lift your spirits a bit.
And small steps. It's
Yeah,
amazing what,
absolutely.
like I said about the book, like a tiny shift can make such a big difference. And I think there's a really great TED talk that is about body language specific to mental health, which if people wanted to look at, it's by, I think it's a professor at Harvard, but I don't quote me, but she speaks a lot about that exact research about, holding your shoulders back or raising your chest up.
Did she do the TED talk? Yeah, I
Mm-hmm.
think I'll dig
Yeah,
out the
I
TED
can.
talk. Yeah,
Yeah.
cool. Yeah, I think it's powerful stuff. Okay, cool. So next user question is, how do you stop the repetitive thoughts? I try to challenge them, but then get into a cycle of thoughts and then end up comparing to others or Googling for reassurance. So yeah, I guess it's just how do you stop that constant cycle of bombardment of thoughts?
Right. So, the immediate question is, thought suppression never works. That's the first one of the first lessons, right? When it comes to psychoeducating clients, is okay. Immediately, if you're trying not to have thoughts, you're probably going to have more. And I always use the metaphor with my clients of if that you had a if a waiter brought you a cup of soda water and you asked for plain water, you can't really push the bubbles down and that would be that can't that wouldn't turn it into plain, fresh water. They would find a teeny tiny way to come up because that's their na that's a natural, that's their natural capacity there. That's what they want to do. And I think that thoughts are very much the same. They really just want to be noticed and like, okay, I'm just going to come out here and try this on and then I'll try something else on. Like I said, I always say like it's just that stream, just let them come at the bottom of their TV screen of your mind. So number one, thought suppression doesn't work. But sort of to go back and talk more about how to manage that is it is ultimately to be an observer, right? Your job is to not fuse with these thoughts as if they're important, right? This is sort of more going into ACT work, right? So if you're being bombarded by a specific thought, it's almost like that the more you just have to observe, oh, there's that thought again, bummer. It's not my favorite thought, but there it is again. Okay, note to self, it showed up again. And to take that perspective, even though I know they can be very, very painful and sometimes very alarming, or oftentimes alarming. But then to flip, so I'm a metaphor girl. You can probably tell
That's
that
great.
already. Do you remember back at this is a concept I say with use with clients. Do you remember back in the day, even in the movies, when someone went to work, they would get this piece of cardboard and they would push it into this little stamper that would stamp when they came to work. And then when they went to lunch, they would come and stamp it again. And the little machine would calculate that you were there for, let's say, 4 hours and 15 minutes or whatever your shift was. I often explain to clients that if you were to use that metaphor, their job is to try to log as many hours on their time card of willingly having that thought. And I'll say to them, like, try to increase log time of having that thought, and note it to yourself that you actually logged that time, and so that your job is to accumulate as much as many minutes as you can of willingly having that thought.
And that's, yeah, to obviously, as you said, to accept the thought, to allow it to be there. Not, you're not pushing it away, right? You're not showing you're scared of it. You're saying, yeah, I'm willing to experience this.
Right.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm a big fan of ACT. Okay, cool. So I always struggle to see where the next question is. Okay, so another listener question is, what are the main differences between OCD and general anxiety disorder?
I would probably my immediate response is general anxiety tends to be more about life stresses, things that are actually happening. Not always. They can all. They. I mean, every all anxiety is about something that hasn't happened yet, right? Or about something that did happen that maybe you're afraid will happen, right? But general anxiety tends to be on the subjects of, you know, general life stresses. OCD tends, with OCD, it tends to have more of this ritualistic experience. You know, of course, generalized anxiety has a lot of mental review as well, but and often a lot of avoidance. But in order to differentiate, OCD is often too that there is a thought or an obsession that doesn't line up with their belief system. That is ego dystonic. Ego dystonic meaning it doesn't. They're having the thought and they're afraid of it, but they don't actually believe that that would happen. Whereas generalized anxiety sometimes is an ego dystonic. It's often that there is a real fear. It might be money. It might be losing their job. It might be mom and dad's health. It might be your children's health or your own. Not your own health is often falls underneath general hypochondria, but it could be also under the lens of GAD. But I think the main thing, differentiation is, of course, OCD has an obsession and a major compulsion ritual, but there is that ego dystonic component as well.
Yeah, cool. No, thank you. Okay, so another list of question is, so how do you live your days not overcome with fear? So I guess that, yeah, that's just a question of how do you live day to day, even though fear is massively there?
Right. Number one, you wake up in the morning. And I think I often use the terms that there's two things you need for recovery. You need hard work and desire to get better.
Yeah.
If you've got those two things, you're going in the absolute right direction. It mightn't be that things are perfect now, but you're absolutely going in the right direction. So for me, the first thing would be to wake up and readdress those two concepts, right? It's too easy to get out of bed and just run up into your day sort of intentionless.
Yeah.
So I often will take a moment to myself and address maybe what my goals are, you know, what my desire is, and then go to work, right? Meaning go to work on that. But I think the other part here is, in terms of setting an intention, is the intention should not be to not have anxiety, because immediately what you're doing is you're showing your brain that anxiety is bad. And when we teach our brain that something is bad, next time it retrieves that information, it will report it to you as if it is bad. Yeah. Right? So I think that setting like a daily intention is a super important part, and I know it has helped me incredibly. But if I were to speak briefly and more in a general terms, I try to surround myself with people and things that support recovery. When I was early in recovery myself, I would lay on my stomach and read books for hours. I would take long, long walks and listen to Tara Brach, who is a meditation and a meditation teacher and a psychotherapist who has a wonderful podcast. And I would walk to that for hours, slowly, very slowly, and take in those concepts. So I think those two are important. But in terms of managing anxieties, you know, self-care is a huge part of that.
Yeah, no, absolutely. As you say, getting good influences into your life is generally one of the best advice I think anyone could ever receive. Yeah, I mean, right, it's helped me massively, yeah. Just getting the right people around me, not just from recovery, but just generally from a happiness point of view. I don't necessarily like the word happiness, but meaningful life, you know. I've gone out and I've sought people that have the same interests as me. Got rid of some of my high school friends, not intentionally, it just kind of fell away because, values change. And what was the other point? That's something you said. I've gone blank now. Talked myself out of it. So the last listener question is, how do you work through panic? So I'm guessing they mean sort of panic attacks.
Right. Okay. 10 out of 10 anxiety equals a panic attack, you know, and I, when we're working on a SUD scale, right, which is a subjective units of distress, that's really rating your anxiety, people will be, you know, it's really kind of okay to live in the 9 below, but then often when people get to that 10 out of 10, they're panicking. How do you survive? What was the question? How do you survive a panic attack?
How do you work through it? How do you work through it?
Okay. One of the best tools that I... Okay, so if it's a real panic attack and you're hyperventilating, one quick tip that I often use is just to breathe, but be counting while you breathe. And you count to 10, and then meaning like 1... 2, like if you're hyperventilating and you need some type of regulation with your breathing, that can be really helpful.
Yeah.
However, some people can get a little ritualistic with that as well. If it's, you know, if there's OCD involved as well, but the best way, I find to work with panic is to ultimately bring it on. If you're trying to get the panic to go away, you're most likely increasing it, in my experience. So it, for me, it's a full body surrender. It's, you know, again, I really think this is important to look at the body language. If someone is leaning forward, I ask them to lean back. If someone is clenching, I basically you ask them to do whatever the opposite is that they're doing in terms of surrendering and allowing this to happen. Right. Now that is really, really scary because, you know, panic does not feel good. And I really resonate with, you know, the terror that that panic can be. But there is great peace in the surrender to it and ultimately even bringing it on. Right.
Yeah.
However, I think until you've got your breathing down, you know, your chances of being able to surrender are very low. So I often will do a breathing with someone as they're panicking if need be.
Yeah, no, the breathing's huge. Like, I'm lucky in the sense I've only ever had one panic attack. It wasn't actually that long ago, and anxiety hasn't really been a massive problem for me in the last sort of 2 years. I mean, it's there occasionally, but I've slowly got rid of it. And I just remember I was on the verge of calling the hospital because I felt like I was literally gonna die, and I'm laughing because I know it not to be true, and it's funny now, but in the moment I was absolutely terrified because I'd never had one. I mean, anxiety had been a big player in my life, but not to this point. And I had a moment of clarity. I was kind of on my knees and I just thought, okay, this could be a panic attack, and I'll know if I correct my breathing, I should be able to kind of calm myself down. And if I can't calm myself down, then there really is an issue and I'll call the ambulance.
Right.
And I focused on my breathing, and within sort of 30 seconds, I'd started to regain myself a bit more.
Right.
And I was like, wow. And I was lucky in the sense that I was aware enough to understand the breathing concept. But obviously, if you've never been taught that, I don't know how long it would have taken me to calm down. I ended up throwing up as well, to give you more information, sort of like a minute after. I don't know why,
I always say throwing up is a good effort, meaning you've had a really good, done a good effort of having your panic if you got to throw up.
But it was actually terrifying. I was like, I never want another one of those again. But the breathing's huge.
Dan Siegel talks about, have you seen Dan Siegel's Vision of the Mind? Yeah, he's a really incredible author, and I think he's a neuropsychiatrist, but maybe I've got his terminology wrong. But he talks about the brain being like your hand, and he uses the hand as a model. And he talks about like this very lower part of your brain is what sets off anxiety. And often when anxiety is set off in the terms of a panic attack or, you know, OCD or, you know, a mistake, you know, it's not that there's an earthquake and there is danger. It often sends off these mistake message.
Yeah.
What often happens is the upper part of your brain, which is where we do a lot of our cognitive restructuring, more executive functioning, you know, figuring out solutions, coming up with plans. That part of the brain, he says, sort of flips your lid and they disconnect. They're not working together like they usually do.
Yeah.
And so when you are panicking, you technically have flipped your lid. This is not anatomically correct, yeah. So I don't want anyone to think that their brain will explode. But these parts aren't connecting. And he talks about the work is learning to reconnect them, even in a state of panic. And often that includes cognitive restructuring, which is the cognitive component of CBT, which is, you know, reinforcing exactly what you did, which is reminding yourself, like, you can't ultimately die from panic. Your brain won't explode, or your body won't implode. Your lungs won't, you know, blow a valve. And it's often just talking yourself through that, and just enough of that can sort of reunite the two, and then you come down.
Okay, no, that's great advice. Hopefully I never have to use it, but hopefully it's comforting to anyone else who struggles with panic.
Right.
Okay, cool. So that's all of the listener questions. I have a few now of my own. So mindfulness for, I'm going to say for OCD, but I guess it's mindfulness generally, is what advice do you have for anyone that wants to be more mindful in their daily life?
Well, mindfulness is a practice. It's not something you can learn, in terms of you don't just read from a book and then you become mindful, different to, I could learn about, Eastern philosophy, and I could learn that through reading, but mindfulness is more of a practice. So I think that's the first step. I've often had clients who get stuck thinking that the more they read, the more it'll click, but it is actually a practice. My advice to those who are interested in maybe starting a mindfulness practice is start very, very small. Right. And read books, of course. And I think that's where you get a lot of your information, and that's wonderful. But start very, very small. And I often start people with really the tools that they already have, which is your five senses. That I feel like is Mother Nature's gift to us. It's a mindfulness gift to us. Use your five senses. What do you see? You know, what do you hear? What do you smell? And I think that it opens up a new way of viewing ourselves and the world, which then allows us to go, oh, and now I'm also going to be an observer of thoughts too, and do that in that same way of just being present with them and noticing, and then you're moving on to not fusing with them too much. I find it really interesting the studies they do with pain sufferers, physical pain, to see how mindfulness actually has reduced suffering, physical pain suffering. We're talking about anxiety, but what's so fascinating to me is how much it has reduced people's experience of physical pain. And so I think in terms of for mindfulness, it is working through, I'm going to observe it, and then I'm actually going to take note of it a little differently as I normally do. So my advice is to start small and be super gentle with yourself as you slip and fall many times, because it's not an easy practice.
Yeah, absolutely. No, the five senses for me is kind of the only thing I focus on when it comes to mindfulness, especially touch. Okay, cool. Right. So what's your advice for people with OCD that they should start doing?
Simply exposures. I mean, mainly because I feel like that's the shift for OCD. Like I talked about at the beginning, there is that's where you teach your brain something else. That after years of you're doing a compulsion, and that's the compulsion is teaching your brain that the thought is very important. As soon as you change that. You're often running, but you have to do that. You have to do that gradually in many, many cases, particularly if you're doing it by yourself.
Yeah.
Can I like throw a second point in?
Yeah, go for it.
Is I always throw in a massive, blanket of compassion on everything. that you do. I talk about compassion so much. I sort of drench clients in this idea just because exposures are hard, and you will slip and fall. You will slip and fall as you do them. And I think what I've experienced both in the eating disorder community and the OCD community, and I do both, is they tend to be just so hard on themselves. Given that they're going through something so difficult, you know, if they got diabetes, they probably wouldn't beat themselves up so much. So, you know, my first answer to you is exposure, but I sort of feel like that you can't do that unless the compassion piece is there as well.
Yeah, no, good advice. It's a similar question. What should they stop doing? And you can't say compulsions, because that's a given.
Judgment.
Okay.
Yeah. Non-judgment, I feel, is sort of the missing link that doesn't get talked about as much as I would like it to be talked about, particularly related to mindfulness practice and ERP work. If you're doing an exposure and the whole time you're doing the exposure, you're going, this sucks, this sucks, this sucks. It's still working, and I'm not going to say that's a bad thing, but I feel like it does. That's very jarring, I think, and it's still teaching your brain that there's something wrong. So I really encourage clients to work on the non-judgment piece and come back to this is where acceptance is so important, which is, okay, it is neither good nor bad, right? It is difficult, and I'm not going to discount that. And this is what I would have them sort of rehearse to themselves, that this is neither good nor bad. It is difficult. So how can I take care of myself during this time?
Really good advice. Judgment's something I really struggle with. Okay, cool. So you're in an elevator going up a few stories, a few floors, and someone turns to you, they've seen you on this podcast, they tell you they have OCD, and they want to know your advice.
My advice?
Yeah, it's a 30-second elevator ride. That's all you got with it.
My immediate instinct would be to do one of these, which is, I see you. I see you, and I see... my immediate instinct is to say, I see you, because I think that is more powerful than any advice I could give them in 30 seconds. I mean, I would, you know, my advice would probably be, you know, listen to you and listen to, you know, any mindfulness stuff you can get, and, you know, make YouTube be your best friend in terms of looking up the best, but my instinct wouldn't be so much advice, but to say, I see you. I see you're not alone. I see how much pain you might be feeling. Even if they smile at me and they seem like they're okay, I would still probably want to connect with them in terms of, like, you are valid in what you've gone through and how much work you're doing.
Yeah, that's a really good point. I mean, it's a good point you said about smiling, even if they're smiling, because for me, I mean, I've always been fairly optimistic, but my smile over the years has been a facade sometimes, when really I was struggling, but I would always have a smile on my face. So it can definitely, some people can use that as a mask.
Right. I often will say, how are you? And then they'll say, I'm good. And I'll go, okay, how are you really? You know, because I'm much more interested in the how are you really.
Yeah.
Right? That's where the good stuff is. And that's where the connection is, right? That's where, you know, I think there's a huge healing that comes from connecting and being seen before any exposure therapy gets done.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah. No, yeah, I agree. Okay, so this next question doesn't have to be kind of mental health related. It could be, it's very sort of general, sort of one human to another. What advice do you have for someone who wants to live an amazing life?
Hmm. I'm a little bit, I'm actually going to kind of where I am in my life right now is what I'll speak to, because I think in every part of my life, my answer would be different.
Yeah.
Right. You know, early 20s, it would be like away from all this mental stuff, right? Like that would have been my answer. Like just do whatever you've got to do, whatever therapy, whatever reading. Where I'm at in my life right now is sort of reconnecting with whatever it is that makes you creative. Not in the terms that you have to go out and paint. It doesn't have to be painting or writing a book, but just getting in touch with the part that got shoved down for so long while you were getting better. Right. Some people are really connected with their creativity, and I'm in awe of them. Even through their struggles, they've stayed connected. But often, I myself or other people I speak to, they shut out this major gift that was given to us, which is creativity or expression or, you know, making something, whatever it might be. I actually find that is so powerful. Mm. And when I'm treating clients, I'll often check in with them about, you know, what do you do that sort of lights up this other part of your brain? Because we know that there's a certain part of your brain that OCD-wise that's being lit up all day long. But how are you lighting up those other creative parts of your brain? And I found that to be incredibly freeing.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I 100% agree. And that comes back to ACT, about living by your values and doing meaningful activities. And and I feel when you finally do something again that does light you up, as you say, it almost makes you forget about your problems, even if only for an hour.
Right.
But the more you can fill your days with those hours, the less hours you struggle with mental health.
Right.
Okay, excellent. And then last question. So you have a billboard in whatever part of the states you're in. What do you want written on that billboard for the world to see? That's the hardest question.
Right. It's funny because billboards usually sell things, and my instinct isn't to sell. It kind of actually is the opposite of all the work that I do. I'm actually going to steal this from my husband, if you don't mind. Two days ago, my husband came home with the brilliant idea that here in America, particularly here in LA, I don't know if they have them where you are. I know in Australia where I am, I don't think I've seen them. But on bumper stickers, they have, I'm the parent of a, you know, such and such elementary school honors student.
Oh, no, we don't.
So a lot of cars, particularly here in LA, on the bumper will say, as I said, I'm the parent of someone who's excelled academically. Mm. And my husband came home and he said, I saw the coolest bumper sticker today. It said, I am the parent of a kind child. Yeah. And he said, I am going to make 1,000 of them. He was going to go down and print them. And he says, I'm going to give them to all the kids as they walk out into summer, you know, and all the parents. He said, because that's the sticker we should be seeing. That's the sticker we should wear on our car. So I think that if I could, I would have a billboard that says, I am the parent, or, you know, I would like to be the parent, or whatever it would say, of a kind child.
I love that. We do. I think Western society generally puts so much emphasis on success, and really, if success is only success if you're happy, not happy again, I hate that word, but you know what I mean, like if you're living your life how you want, that is success.
Right.
And grades in and of themselves does not mean success.
Right.
Yes,
right.
That's a good message.
Yeah, I don't know how I would phrase it, but
I
think that's a message. If we all could just be a part of the village who raised a child who is kind, whether you're the parent or the grocery store owner or whatever, we could be the parent of a child who is kind. I think the world would be a better place.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. Yeah, no, very much so. Cool. I mean, that is all my questions and all the listener questions. There's been loads of advice here, so I know people are going to get a lot out of it. And you brought a different perspective as well to a lot of, with OCD, obviously, a lot of the questions are the same I ask people, just I've maybe worded them differently. Because obviously, OCD manifests itself in many different themes, but the core is a very, I say, simple, it's a very kind of one-dimensional kind of illness. And you definitely gave different perspectives on those questions, which was great. So,
I'm
yeah, thank
glad.
you.
Of course, of course.
And so, how can, I mean, I'll put all the links and stuff in the show notes for this, but how can people find out more about you, your podcast, etc.?
So I have a podcast that I release about monthly. It's mostly mindfulness based, and it's usually, often all my clients will start to have stuff of the same theme, and so I'll say, okay, that's the universe telling me I need to do this particular topic. So you can, it's called Your Anxiety Toolkit. You can get it on iTunes, or you can stream it live from my website, which is KimberlyQuinlan-LMFT.com. LMFT is Licensed Marriage and Family Therapist acronym. I'm also on Facebook. It's Kimberly Quinlan LMFT again. Or you can get me on Instagram, which I think is where I am the most. And that's also Kimberly Quinlan LMFT.
Cool. All right, brilliant. Yeah, again, all
Yeah.
those links will be in the show notes. People
Great.
can't remember it.
No, it's a
Yeah,
long name. It's a long website name, unfortunately.
that's fine. Cool. No, thank you very much. Hey guys, so I really hope you enjoyed my chat with Kimberly there. I hope you got a lot out of it. Everything she mentioned, including her podcast links, will be in the show notes of this episode, and you can get that at theocdstories.com/podcast. That's theocdstories.com/podcast. And also, if you haven't checked out, we do have a Patreon page, which is where you give a sort of a monthly donation to the podcast, and in exchange, there's various rewards and levels that I give back in return for that support. If you have the capacity to do so and you feel inspired to do so, please go check those rewards out and see how you can support the podcast and the podcast can support you further. And the link will be in the show notes for that as well. Take care.